Welcome to Brand Appeal. We're talking about brand storytelling in the digital age. I'm your host, Shannon Peel, and today I'm taking it on a little bit of a tangent as I talk with Rich LaMonica, who is the podcast host of Misfit Nation. It is a podcast for military vets, and what Rich does is he helps military vets transition from life in the military to civilian life. We talked about everything from coming out of the military to trying to find a job, what it's like to be on the job, along with a number of different struggles that military people have. If you know somebody that has been in the military, who is in the military or thinking about going into the military, this episode is for you. Rich, thank you so much for joining me here today on Brand Appeal. I've got one question for you.
All right.
What would you like to be known for?
Helping my fellow veterans find their path to mental stability and, I guess, freedom outside of the uniform.
Yeah, that must be a real transition, going from being in the military to coming back non-military life.
It's a big jump. When I served 22 years, and 7 years ago this month is when I got out of the military, and day or two after, I didn't know what to do with myself at all. I mean, for 22 years, you do everything by the book. You get up, you go do PT, you put uniform on, you work, rinse, repeat, and do it again. And then all of a sudden, I didn't have to do that no more. So it was like, what do I do with my hands? I didn't know what to do. And it takes a while, pretty good strength in your mind to transition out and do things right. It took me a year to find a job. No one wanted to hire me because they all thought I wanted a lot of money because of how long I was in the military. I just wanted a job. I wanted a purpose. It was a hard role for me, and it humbled me a little bit because I thought I'd get a job right away. But it also taught me a lot about myself, how strong I could be, and my family.
Well, I do want to talk about the difficulty of getting a job, because I had the same thing, not because I was in the military. When I got to a certain age, all of a sudden, it became much harder for me to get a job, to the point where I pretty much was stressed out, hit the bottom. And now even the idea of sending out a resume causes panic attacks. When it comes to trying to find that job and you can't find it, how did you stay mentally strong and keep going? You know, it's difficult.
Well, I knew that I had something to give others. I had skills in me that people needed. I just had to get in the right door. I think it was 8 months maybe before I got my first interview. So it took 8 months to get an interview. So I drove from Tennessee up to Washington, D.C. to get an interview, and only to be asked the question, what college did you go to? And I told them my college, and they said, oh, okay. I said, oh, wow. All right. So I was driving home from there. One of my friends called me and said, I have a job here that you need to apply for. This is what you need to be doing. I drove home. I did that application. I got a call while I was on a retreat with my wife. We were like doing kayaking and rock climbing and stuff. And I got a call saying, well, you have an interview in St. Louis on Friday morning. I said, good. I get back Thursday night. I got home. I realized I don't have a suit ready. So I pressed the suit and put it in my car. And I drove to St. Louis, the 3 hours out there. Did my interview, and exactly 1 year from the day I left the Army to the day I got hired, I got 365 days of unemployment. But that whole time, I knew that I had something I can give. Anyone that was going through the same stuff knew that they had something to give, and they had to prove it. Just had to get your foot in that one door, and that's what happened to me. I got my foot in one door. I stayed there 2 years, and then I moved on to another position.
It's hard when you have to restart and prove yourself. It's almost like everything that you did doesn't have value. When it did, totally have value. All your skills have value. But hiring managers are not able to see it because they can't match it one-to-one.
Right. And they don't know how to scale what we did, especially when you did a career of 22 years. They don't know the scale of what we did. And most of the hiring managers were younger than me at that point because I did 22 years in the Army. These are people that are probably 28, 30 years old that are hiring managers now. I'm over 40 at this point. And they're telling me that I don't fit in there because I'll be too expensive for them. I never even asked a price, but I was already expensive for them.
Well, yeah, because a lot of companies, they kind of jumped over the X generation. Yeah. I have friends who were in positions and they were laid off or let go by the banks. And then the banks turned around and hired three people to do the same job.
And it's definitely, it's cost savings for them.
You know, it's a lack of loyalty to people that work for them. That's for sure. It also is showing that ageism has gone from 65 to 45.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the X generation has had a difficult time in the job market to begin with, just because of when we started our jobs, what jobs were available. Researchers didn't research our generation. Marketers ignored our generation. Governments ignored our generation. They're all talking about the baby boomers and the millennials. Is a difficult time for us in our 40s and now coming on to 50, where, you know, we're having to start over, but we're just being let go because we're too expensive. We're being let go because they value younger
and less expensive to them. So that's what they feel right there, because you have too much experience.
Now that you've been working, what do you see as the biggest struggle for veterans when they are trying to work in a corporation?
In a corporation, they work too hard. So veterans are used to giving it all day long. And once you get to the civilian sector, it's not like that. You get a task in the civilian sector, the person will look at it. Oh, I got 3 months to do this. I'm going to take exactly 3 months to do this. Whereas the veteran will say, 3 months, I can do that in a week.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do the job in a week. And all of a sudden they're getting kind of pushed to the side because they're showboating or they're the spotlight or I'm better than you thing. So they don't fit in with that culture. So most veterans only stay in their first job about a year after getting out of the military, unless they started their own business and then they try to find something else. So at my first job, I made it a point not to be a statistic. So I stayed there 2 years, even though I knew I was losing the passion there. I had to get out of there 2 years and moved on to the job I'm doing now.
Like, you've done all that work in the military. You come into the civilian world. How often are you underemployed?
Oh, that's a big problem with the veteran workspace is underemployment. Because they places where they just have to show up, or places where they're underpaid, or they just sit there and look at a computer all day and really don't have a lot of things challenging them like they did for their career or the time they were in service. So a lot of them are underemployed. And then there are some that just quit, like if they were going through that cycle I went through that 1 year, they just quit and become unemployed and to feel like the world's against them and be stay that unemployed route. So then you have those two camps, the unemployed, and then those who are employed and happy, which it took me a year to get to employment, but I found my path and now I'm in a really good place right now. And I'm able to, smile every day when I go to work, and I still work with soldiers, so I get to see them and laugh and see the same trends that happened when I was in the military. It's the same kids, just a lot younger now than when I was in, but I see that and I'm happy. But I also think back to the underemployed and unemployed guys and gals. How do we get them to get out of their own way, for some of them, and move on to better things? And for some of them, that the answer is entrepreneurism. Start their own businesses and find something they're passionate about and thrive forward and maybe hire veterans within them.
The only option for someone like that, that has that drive, needs to be working at a higher level. That causes people to be threatened. So the only option is self-employment. I'm Canadian, so I know that there's a ton of resources out there for Canadians. I'm not really sure about the Canadian military specifically, but our military is not nearly the size of your military. What kind of services are available to veterans who want to, you know, strike out and go on their own and run a business and hire other veterans?
So there's programs through the Veterans Affairs Administration here in the States that help you. You can choose a track. So you can either take an education track where they'll pay for your school if it's something different than you did in the military, to try to become better. Like if you want to become a lawyer, if you want to become a doctor, they'll pay for the first portions of that to get you going. Or you can become a small business owner and they'll give you that upfront funding to try to get all the equipment you need to get going and the skills you need to build your business plan and get that thing going. And they'll teach you and coach you through it and they'll be on your side for, I think it's the first year while you're still opening.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great resource for them.
That's amazing that they have that. Now, are you familiar with vet-led companies that have hired other vets and are showing up as those North Stars of success that other vets can look to?
I just interviewed a guy on my show the other day, Trey Chandler. He runs a business called Tennessee Home Solutions. He's just getting out of the military, but he already started the business. So he teaches his veterans, he brings them in as interns and teaches them how to find properties that are not on market, rehab them and sell them, get that flip going and get that residual income and do things like that. And I've seen him see that as a success plan right now, because I mean, he's just starting, but I already can see the lights on with just talking to him. I can see the light and the passion that he has to help others and help, you know, basically get himself out of his own way and become a transition success. Then I've had others on there. There's a man in Florida. He started, like, if your house has a fire, there are the people that come in and clean it up and take all the residue out of it, residual ash and stuff out, need to rehab your home. And he hires solely veterans. Mm-hmm. And he was a retired officer, and he aims to help veterans in their transition period by getting them into his company and then actually franchising them through his company. So that's a success model right there.
That's a great model. Now, there's a big piece when you come out, you've transitioned, you've gotten a job, but a lot of people struggle with the transition, whether they have PTSD or a physical disability, or just feel like the world is out to get them because it wasn't what they thought it was going to be. What are some ideas that you have or that you tell people that they need to do in order to get that mindset shift?
You have to stay active. You can't get down on yourself and let yourself just wind up in a lull or into that dark room and just sit there looking at walls. There's a lot of my sisters and brothers, they'll come out, they'll put on a great face, like everything's fine. And then they'll see one thing on the news or they'll see one thing out on the street and their mind just triggers. And or it's an anniversary of something that they witnessed overseas. Everything is a trigger for everyone, even fireworks around here, the 4th of July and everything like that. The fireworks, a lot of people, that drives them over the edge. Even though they know it's coming and it's an annual thing, it still drives them over the edge. So if you know that's coming, leave. Go find a quiet place for that weekend. Get away. If you know that that date is coming up, the anniversary of a very sullen occasion, do something that week that would make the person that we lost proud. Or that month, do something that whole month. So for us, like the Misfit Nation, we lost our soldier on December 31st, 2010. So every December 31st, me and one guy that's still here, we go and drink by a memorial bench with them. And we make sure we reach out to every one of our brothers and sisters to make sure everyone's doing good. And then we all get that thumbs up and then we drive forward. And for the next year, because it's right at the end of the year, we all just push forward to make sure we're doing positive things and making a positive impact in our communities and the world as a whole. So if you stay active and if you feel the demons coming, do something. Call somebody is the number one thing. Call someone. Don't try to beat it yourself. You're not a psychiatrist or social worker. You can't heal yourself. You've got to get help. And it takes a tribe to help you, to get you through these things. And I mean, I had to go get help after I got out just to get my mind straight because I was stuck in the thought of the why. Why did I come home and they didn't? It finally caught up to me after I retired. And I got help and I sat down with a pretty good doctor here, and He had me just talk through it and made me feel 100% better and got my mindset shifted to a positive mindset and how to get myself mindful and go straight forward. And
why did you go into the military to begin with? I mean, that is a huge commitment. On the job risk is high, especially for your country. So why did you go?
Well, this goes back to when I was like, I guess 4 or 5 years old, sitting with my dad watching TV. And I'm not sure if it was Vietnam or like one of the wars in Israel, but it was on the TV and I was watching. I said, Dad, I want to do that. That's what I want to be. And my dad was in the army. He served with Elvis in the army. That's what I want to be. I want to be a soldier just like you were and do the stuff they're doing on the TV there, pointing guns at people and having fun. So, you know, at that point, I was so young, I didn't realize they're really killing people. Videos. Flash forward to high school. I was just taking classes to get through high school so I can go in the military. That's all I was going to do, join the army. After my junior year, since I started a year early, I had to have my dad go with me to the recruiter. I said, Dad, we got to go to the recruiter so I can sign up for the Army. He said, no, you're not going. I said, what do you mean? That's all I've been waiting to do my whole life. He said, enough of us have served. You got to go to college. I said, well, heck, I don't have any classes that'll get me in college. Whole senior year, I had to take all the maths, all the sciences, and go to class while all my friends were hanging out doing nothing. Mm-hmm. They were going home at noon. I was in school all day, going to class, and trying to get all these extracurricular things in. And then I had to take my SAT. I passed it somehow, got into college. I did a year in a business college, and then I transferred to St. Peter's College where I played football for a year and a half, two seasons. And then I realized, I said, Dad, look, it was a great ride, but I'm going in the Army now. You can't stop me now. He said, all right, just don't go infantry. And that's how I got in. There's 1993.
If you didn't go infantry, what did you go? Which did you choose?
Chemical operations specialist, so weapons of mass destruction.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a total difference.
Now, I'm assuming somewhere around my age, you're looking at probably just after the first Iraq Gulf War when you entered that.
Yeah.
So and
directly after, yeah.
That was one of the things that they were always looking for, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And then the second Iraqi war was all about finding those.
Yes.
You were much needed on the ground and gone a lot from your family. How did you and your family manage that?
Well, it's funny. My wife and I we just celebrated our 28th anniversary. So she was with me my whole career through peacetime and wartime. Mm-hmm. Before the 9/11, I was gone all the time anyway for training or whatever. So she got used to not having me around. So we'd have this like a new start all the time when I come home. And then 9/11, I was actually in Kuwait on the border of Iraq when it happened. I was already gone when it happened. The shock and awe over there. And it kind of, we came back in December and refit and then started training again to go right back. So forward combat deployments and multiple other operational deployments in there. And it takes a strong wife, a strong partner, I should say, this is men and women that serve, a strong partner to come home to. And the person that's serving has to understand that they're not in charge. Mm-hmm. That helps out a lot because when you're gone, you don't handle anything. The person home is handling everything. And like my wife handled the finances, handled the child, my daughter, handled our dogs, handled the house, took care of everything. I came home. I would just sit back and say, what do you want me to do? What am I allowed to do? Mm-hmm. And that's what I would do just to keep that peace. And then you get through the honeymoon phase. Then you're back to kind of normalcy about 6 months later. And then all of a sudden, I'm right back in the cycle to leave again. So you never really get used to being home.
That would be hard. How many divorces happen in the military compared to civilian life?
There's a pretty good number of divorces. As you get to the higher ranks, most people are on their second or third marriage. And obviously, exception, I was the only one in my peer group that stayed married to the same person.
Why bother getting married when you know you're going to be gone that long?
Right. It's
right. Especially when you've done it once, right? Like, okay, you've done it once. You probably had kids. You probably had a family divorce. Why do it again and again when you know that you're not going to be there? And then you have to come back and deal with all of the drama of not being there.
It definitely takes a special breed to stick it out and do that. And the guys and gals I've seen get married multiple times, I never understood why they would keep doing it or why go back to the fence that way. Maybe because they thought they had to be married to be with someone. I don't know. But knowing the pain that they went through the first time to do it again, I said, there's no way. There's no way I would do that.
No, I mean, I'm divorced, well, almost 10 years ago now. And
I haven't either.
And I don't have the issue of, you know, someone being deployed or being deployed myself.
It's a rough thing, but both partners work together, it'll work out.
I mean, obviously you made it work out, but you had a specific type of spouse,
right,
who was able to understand, take control of the house. You didn't come in and try to take control of it while you were there. You both respected each other's roles within your marriage. We're basically supporting each other. That's the only way that will work, pretty much.
Right.
What was it like coming back, though? Like when you came back and now your wife is used to you being gone all the time. And now all of a sudden you're around all the time. What kind of transition did that impose on you? And how did you get through that in order to stay strong?
It can almost be like a sitcom or a comedy show, I guess, because it's all love and flowers when you first come home, and then you go through the honeymoon phase, just kind of like when you first get married, you get the honeymoon phase, then it kind of wanes off a little bit. And then all of a sudden she's asking, when are you going again? When are you leaving again? Are you going somewhere soon? Because I can't take you here anymore. You got to go.
She had 22 years of basically living on her own.
Right.
And now you're in her space 24/7. Like you would just come and have a vacation. Every once in a while, her husband would show up for vacation. She would have a vacation at that time. And then he would go off and she would have basically a single life, but paid with support of you with the paycheck. I would find that extremely hard. All of a sudden that the person's always around. And if you don't have a job and you don't know, have a purpose, and you don't know what you're going to be doing, and you're just sitting there kind of like a bump on a log.
Yeah.
That would drive me nuts.
When we first had our daughter, she said she was going to take 5 years off to raise her. Stayed those first 5 years, and that lasted, I think, 6 months. She's like, I got to get a good job. Mm-hmm. I said, all right, go get a job. So I supported that. And she worked almost our whole marriage. She's worked a teacher, were with kids at some point. Now she's a teacher again. She always had to work, so that kept her mind busy as well. Early in our marriage in the military, she had some really great mentors, fellow spouses that told her the ropes from their upbringing in the military. And then we got to Fort Campbell the first time, we met Donna Jones, and Donna Jones took her under her wing, and she taught her all her ways, and we're still friends with her now and her daughters. It's that really helped her out a lot with her mindset as being a military spouse.
Because it's kind of extended family.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of civilian people don't have that kind of camaraderie in their career. I'm pretty sure you probably don't have that camaraderie that you had in the military. How is that to get used to?
Well, in my first job, I didn't have that camaraderie at all, because it was a lot of, like you said earlier, a lot of millennials were working there. And then there was us. It was them and then the us. Mm-hmm. And then the us, none of us really had a lot in common, because we did different things in the military, or we didn't work together in the military. So we were proud of our military service, but we really weren't a tight-knit group. But where I am now, it's all retired military dudes. So it's like we go right, it's like being in a locker room, and we do jokes all day. We make fun of each other, and we just have a blast every time we go to work. So
you still have that extended family.
Right.
Do you still have the support of the military after you're gone?
Yes. As long as you reach back. I mean, they're not going to reach out to you. You have to reach out to them.
TV shows and media have talked a lot about PTSD, and those that come back but aren't able to transition. You know, suicide is one of those things that I am extremely passionate about talking about, because I think we need to talk about it in order to find support for people so they realize that they're not alone in their fight. How much of a topic is that people talk about, or is it still really hush-hush in the military?
It's not hush-hush anymore. After about, I'd say, 10 years ago-ish, 10, maybe 9, 10 years ago, when the numbers started going up and up, because people were going on multiple deployments, and then seeing too many of their brothers and sisters not coming back, and seeing so much bad stuff. And there's only so much bad stuff you can see before your mind just goes completely haywire. And it got to a point where there was 22 veterans a day killing themselves. In the early days of those numbers, a lot of those were Vietnam veterans, which, not shocking, because they didn't get any help when they came home. Mm-hmm. They came home, they were spit on, they were called baby killers. When they went to the VA, they were told, no, that's not service connected, you can go home. And they wouldn't go back to file again, because that was a play that the VA would do to make the veteran work harder to get their compensation. And most of them would just quit after one try. So a lot of them were starting to kill themselves as they got older, in their 60s and 70s. And then as the younger generation, my generation of global war on terrorism is coming out, a lot of them are starting to kill themselves. And now that's what we're seeing now. A lot of the younger generation is the ones that are, we're losing them now at a pretty high rate, about the same rate, 22 a day. That's why at the beginning of my show, I put out the anonymous phone number so people can call that number, get the help they need, instead of making a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
It's a tough nut to crack. You know, I hear a lot of people nowadays talking about the millennials are more social justice. They're more aware. They're kinder generation than the baby boomers. But what you just said about the Vietnam vets when they came back, it was kind of the same type of mentality, like, but a different generation in their 20s, pointing a finger saying, you know, you're doing the wrong thing, you're a baby killer. It's that woke type of mentality. We're right, you're wrong, and we're going to vilify you for it. Do we still have that in the military, or was that really kind of fixed and just in that time period?
It was fixed after the 70s, I guess. I didn't really see a lot of that. I seen it right after 9/11, when we were coming home. We landed in Shannon, Ireland. There was protesters in Ireland, and a woman ran up to us and called us baby killers. I was like, we haven't killed anybody. They took down two of our towers, killed a bunch of Americans. I mean, we didn't kill anybody yet. She's like, oh, you're baby killers, because they were paid to be protesting us to try to get us out of their airport. So we had to run out of the airport. That's the only thing I've ever seen where people protested against us as far as being military.
Well, you make another really good point. They were probably paid to protest against you in order to put forward a different agenda. I don't like protests because I believe most all of them are like that. You're not willing to listen to the other side. You're just there to scream and shout and jump up and down and be part of the problem and not part of the solution. And when you got over to the other side, into Afghanistan and Iraq and that, What kind of reception did you receive?
From the local people, mixed, I guess. Iraq was I was put into the Sunni triangle, so that was Saddam's, loved his area, Saddam Hussein's area of growth, and all his supporters were there. So they really hated us completely. They really did not like us at all. So every day we drive out, we get shot at. But then that was, I guess that would be like you're 16 years old and above doing that. But then there was younger kids that loved us and older gentlemen that would just come up and shake our hands and say thank you, because they've been 30 years being told what to do by this crazy guy, as Saddam Hussein. But everything in the middle hated us just because that's what they were taught for so long. And that's all they knew, was to hate anyone from the West. It was they're evil doers. And over time, a lot of them would come to us and ask us for help after they would do stuff to us. Like, being the diplomat soldiers, we had to be at the point, yeah, we'll help you, but we know in 2 days you're going to be against us again anyway. So we'll just play this game as long as we can.
That would be confusing.
Yeah. Afghanistan was a totally different world, I guess, is a way to put it. My first time in Afghanistan was in the southern desert, and right where the Taliban grew up, right where they were started. So we actually took over a Canadian base there down in Kandahar. I think it was about a 50-50 split of who liked us and who didn't like us there. Right outside the base, they loved us because we're pumping money into their area. As you get a little further out, we weren't giving money to them, so they can care less about us. Right. They'll tell the Taliban where we are, what we're wearing, how to kill us, and all that stuff. But right outside, they'll be polite to us because they knew we can reach out and grab them, and we paid them. So then I went to Kunar, which is up in the mountains, in the northeastern mountains of Afghanistan, my next tour. And there it was, I guess, more humble people up there, more hardened people, because they're mountain people, and they respected everyone. If you respected them, they respected you. If you went in there with an attitude that you're going to change them, they just ignored you. Mm-hmm. But if you went in there with an attitude that you want to see what they need, they were all over you. They'll feed you. They'll take care of you. I got wounded. They took care of me when I got wounded. So they were great people.
Yeah, because it's a very different culture.
Yes.
A very different culture. One that the West looks down on and triggers a lot of anger in feminists. I was in London in 2019. While I was there, I ran into a family who was from... actually, I think they were from Saudi Arabia, not Afghanistan. But, you know, she was wearing the whole couldn't see your face, everything. And the daughter was a little tiny little girl. She started laughing at me and behind her dad. So I had a conversation with the dad. But the whole time, I swear, I was just thinking, oh, my gosh, how hot she must be. Why in the world is she wearing that here when she's not in whatever country she's in? Because we don't understand, because we don't grow up in that. It's not our culture. It's not our religion. How hard was it to kind of get your head around some of that stuff?
It was pretty hard, especially in Kandahar, Afghanistan, because there, since it was the birthplace of the Taliban, what they would do is they'd have their young men wear those same burqas, but strapped with explosives underneath them. Because they thought we wouldn't go near them because they were women. But the people that liked us would tell us they were coming. Look out for this person wearing this. It's not a woman. That's a dude. But I'd have my female soldiers out there just scanning. I said, look, you know what women look like better than I do when I do these things. I said, for me, they all look like people from Star Wars when they're wearing those things walking down the road. I said, you look at them, tell me if they're the right person. If not, we're going to take them out. And we captured most of them. It became a game for us to see man or woman or good or bad person. So it's just a weird thing. In Iraq, there was a big divide between those who were either fully covered or just westernized with makeup on and just being happy.
Yeah, because it's a personal choice. I'm in Vancouver. We have lots of different cultures here. It's very multicultural. And the odd time, there'll be somebody that I'll see in a burqa, but not very often.
Right.
And it's just so different. But we do have a lot of those patriarchal Eastern cultures here. It takes time to understand them. It takes a lot of effort to respect their beliefs and understand that, you know what, that's what they believe and that's okay. Let's find those common threads. Let's find what makes us the same and not focus so much on what makes us different. In a war zone, where you actually take the time to get to know someone and find out how you're the same?
Well, Afghanistan, what I did both times I went there, I read books on Afghanistan, on the culture, on the norms and everything. And I read one book three times on the way there, just so I'd have it all down pat, so I'd know the right way to greet a man, to stay away from a woman, not to touch a woman at all, unless a woman is present, let her touch him. the way to thank them for stuff, the way to give them gifts. I learned a lot. Iraq kind of learned by watching the TV, and because we had a war there before, kind of seen how to do things. We had cultural cards and stuff. Afghanistan, there was books, and I talked to my buddies who had been there before, what they went through. And then, of course, the books really helped me a lot. And I passed them off to my soldiers. Says, look, just read this. We'll all be good. We'll get out of this okay. And I lost one soldier in 4 deployments. So it's not a bad, ratio. One is bad, but it's still not a bad ratio. Just lose one.
Not considering how many were lost, because that's a big thing. Now, you guys have Memorial Day, which is a big deal in the States.
Yes.
Every once in a while, after Memorial Day, we'll see those social media posts that say, hey, this is what Memorial Day is really about. It's not about barbecues. What do you do on Memorial Day?
Memorial Day morning, I usually go visit the benches like we do on the day of his death. I cleaned it off this year since I was the only one left here. I cleaned it. I put his beer down there. I gave him a nice tea, a beer. I talked to him a little bit, talked to my other buddies on their memorials, drank a beer with all of them, and then came home and just hung out with my wife and just drank beer and watched, I think, the race that was on that day.
So it's okay to enjoy yourself.
Just enjoy yourself, but also take a breath and think about or thank those who made the ultimate sacrifice so you can enjoy yourself. That's all. I don't care if you enjoy yourself. Before I joined the military, I was doing the same stuff. So I mean, I'm not going to be a hypocrite about it.
Okay, well, we have Remembrance Day here, but it's not a holiday. It's a quasi-holiday. Most people work on that day, but governments and banks close down or other places will go, well, we'll give you the holiday in February, but you have to work in November. But we all take that minute of silence on November 11th to remember. We don't have the military history that you do. And we don't have the big military engine. The biggest employer in the States is the military. Am I correct?
Pretty much Department of Defense, yeah. It's a pretty big number.
So there's a lot of people that have gone through the military in one form or another.
Yes.
Well, besides the people that are in your workforce and, you know, in your social circle, but how often do you run into vets down there?
Around here, there's 30,000 veterans that live right outside where I am right here.
That's so a city.
The military base is 20 miles from my house. Most of them retire there from there and stay here because it's just nice here. You got woods, you got lakes, you got streams, you got everything that could keep you relaxed. And you got a big employer, which is the base. So
people still work on base even after they're gone?
Oh, yeah. That's where I work on base now. So I retired and now I'm back on base working.
Ah, so you haven't really left the military.
I just don't have to wear a uniform anymore.
What's the difference between being a civilian on base and being a soldier on base?
I get to go home every night. Every night I get to go home. So I can do all the same stuff all day, but I say, see you later. Have fun, boys.
So you're doing the same jobs?
I'm still training soldiers basically the same way I did when I was wearing the uniform.
But you're paid different.
Way better, yes.
A lot of people who are in our age bracket that are running around as consultants and coaches and getting paid a better rate per hour to go and basically train people who are younger than them in the corporate world. It's nice to see that the military is doing that as well. Now that you're home, what kind of hobbies did you start?
Well, I started, especially during the pandemic, I made myself very busy. I got my master's degree from Georgetown University in 2020. And then since I wasn't able to walk the stage for that one, I decided to go for my doctorate. So I'm going for my doctorate right now for Homeland Security. I taught myself how to make moonshine. I podcast now. I wrote a book like the one behind me here. I'm writing a second book. And then I volunteered with a veteran organization downtown here. I'm a co-leader of the veteran group, and we mentor children so that they can be the next leaders of our area.
Wow. That's a lot of things to do.
Yes.
You are doing a lot of things. So for a kid who just basically got through high school to get into the military and wasn't really looking for, you know, the academic type of career, you're getting your doctorate. Are you going to go get a job with that? Or are you just having it to have it?
I'm going to get it to become a consultant and probably an adjunct professor so I can teach the next generation.
What motivates you to continue to push yourself? Because you're pushing yourself more than the regular person.
I think the challenge accepted thing. When someone told me I couldn't get my doctorate, so I took that as a challenge. All right, challenge accepted. So I applied, I got in, and I've been pushing forward halfway through it now. The podcast, I figured I had 8 hours left in my week where I wasn't doing anything. So let me do this podcast. So I started a podcast. And when the Travis Manion Foundation started up here in town, they asked me if I wanted to join in and lead. I said, yeah, I can do that. I have some time. I can jump in with that. So I just keep doing it. And I keep myself busy and motivated. And all of it, I'm still passionate about all of it. That helps a lot. Mm-hmm. If I wasn't passionate about all those things, I wouldn't do any of them, but I have a passion for all of them. And then I also spend time with my wife and my four dogs. So we have quality time too.
I mean, that's a lot of stuff to do in a week. You have to have a high level of productivity in order to do everything that you do. Is it your military training teach you that, or were you always that way?
I think I was always that way in some aspect or some form or another. And I think my parents taught me at an early age, just watching them, both of them working two jobs when we were kids. So it was four of us. They were trying to make us have a better life than they did. So both of them worked at least two jobs at all times during our formative years. And then dad just settled into one career for basically from about 12 on until he retired. They showed us the value of hard work at that point and where it gets you. So I think that resonated in my head into, if you keep working hard, good things will happen. And that's what I keep doing.
Well, keep telling me that, will you? Just keep telling me that. What kind of advice would you give people who want to be more productive, who want to put more into their day?
I'm saying stop getting in your own way. If you want to do something, do it. If you think it, do it. If you dream it, do it. If you have a goal, chase it. It's not going to chase you. Don't sit back and say, I have this goal. It's going to happen someday. You have to do something. The goal isn't going to come with, hey, buddy, let's make this happen. You have to be there and do the goal. You have to do all the steps to make that goal complete. If not, it's just a thought. Mm-hmm. Like me, I have all my goals written on the wall in front of me right here. So every day I have to see them to make sure I hit all of them during the year. And I think that's the best thing to do. If you see them, you have to do them.
That's amazing. I don't.
You have space right there in the wall. You can draw stuff on.
I know. I could have it right there, or I could have it on the window right there. I bought these pens to write on my window. There's no excuse for me not to have my goals written right there. Although they are top of mind. Every day I'm working on my goal, and every day I have the vision of what it's going to be. But I don't do anything else because I'm so focused on my one thing. But you have multiple things that you've got to focus on. How supportive is your wife in all of this stuff that you're doing? Because you've come home, you've gotten a job, and yet you're still going out and doing those extra things that don't involve her.
I try to involve her in most of them. Like I had her on the podcast, like the third episode. She was on the third episode.
Oh, cool. I'm going to have to go take a look at that.
Grudgingly, she was on there, but she was on there. So she was my first in-house interview. So I wanted her to be part of it. That's why I had her on there. The Travis Manion Foundation, I have her go out with us and we do like rock marches downtown. I make her come out and do that with us. So I tell her we're going and we go, and I usually buy her breakfast or lunch after. It depends. So she wins in that aspect. But most things I do, I try to include her, minus the school stuff, since she said she's not doing any more school. So she stays away from me on that portion.
One of those things that I am always in awe of are those couples that make it through, that have decades together. You know, my parents have been married now well over 50 years, and brother's been with his wife for 20 some odd years. Of course, I didn't make it to 20. I made it to 16. It does take something extra to have a marriage that survives the test of time. What do you think the reason you guys have been able to make it where other people weren't able to?
Communication. Always telling each other when we're doing something stupid or when we're doing something great. Make sure you talk it out. And don't just do something without the other person knowing. Don't buy something without the other person knowing, unless it's a gift. But don't just spend money that you don't have and cause more hardships, financial hardships. That's usually the killer of most marriages, especially young marriages. And as you grow older, just make sure you always talk to each other. Don't go to bed angry. And don't let someone leave the house without telling them you love them. So every morning when she drives to school, she'd leave at 5:30. I'd be outside in my shorts and t-shirt, telling her I love her and waving to her as she drove up the street. And, you know, the neighbor's like, wow, that's weird. Yeah, but you'll do it someday too. You'll understand.
Some people are made to be married. How do you and your wife take the time to make sure that you take that time to talk to each other when you're so busy?
I think we learned over time that you have to just press the brakes and sit down and just either at dinner or when you're trying to watch TV at night and before one of us falls asleep on the couch, you talk to each other and make sure you get everything out at that point so that you don't leave anything on the table that night. And then the next day start over again. And, you know, you're going to have your ups and downs, but you have to fight through those ups and downs and always never go to bed angry and never let someone leave without saying you love.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming by Brand Appeal today and sharing with me how you transitioned from the military into civilian life. It's trials and tribulations that most people in the military have in that situation, as well as some really great advice on how people can create an appealing life, career, and or business by understanding who they are and knowing their own values and where they fit.
No problem. It was a pleasure being on this side of the mic with you, and had a great time.
Oh, and before we leave, though, I want to know, because I know my listeners are going to want to know, that book that's behind you. Can you tell me about that book and where people can find it?
It's the 13-Step Guide to Success. So during the first year of COVID, I was writing a post every month on Facebook. At the end of it, you made it to this level of Jumanji. You made it through this, and it's starting at this again. And the end of the year, my daughter's like, you should put that in a book. So I started writing it, and I had her edit it because she got published right out of high school. She was my editor for this book. And
oh, impressive. Really,
yes, very impressive and very, I would just say, very hardcore in her editing skills. And so it came out in December of last year, December 21. It's basically a step of how to be a better you, how to make you a better person, how to make you better in your community, to make your community better and everyone else around you better. And I have it, tips from my dad in there, Colin Powell. There's all kinds of stuff in there that's valuable. You can find it on Amazon, 13-Step Guide to Success by Rich LaMonica. And it's also on our website, themisfitnation.com.
What is the Misfit Nation?
So the Misfit Nation is our podcast now, but it's actually a group of soldiers that came together in 2010 on the battlefield of Kandahar, Afghanistan. We were forged in fire, and with the loss of one of our misfits over there, Michael Beckerman, it became even tighter, a tighter bond. And we've just grown solider, more solid as the years have gone on. Now it's 12 years now since we left Kandahar. We try to spread that positive mindset, not just within our group, but outside our group, to get those tentacles out there. And that's why the podcast was developed, basically to give veterans a voice. So veterans come on, tell their story, while also bringing people like when I brought you in there, mm-hmm. to give veterans tips and tricks on how to make their story better or how to market themselves better. That's what we're doing now. Try to bring a lot of experts in to help veterans in their entrepreneur skills or veterpreneurs so they can be better. And just basically advocate for veterans now. That's what it's for.
That is a wonderful purpose. I just know in my heart that there are hundreds of people out there that are very thankful that Misfit Nation exists and that you have this group and this support place where they can come and learn and find the motivation, ideas in order for them to create this appealing life, career, or business in the vet world. Where can people find this information online?
At our website is the best part, themisfitnation.com. You can see all our shows either in video or audio form there. And then, of course, you can buy our gear. We have shirts, t-shirts, sweatshirts. The hats are sold separately. The book is on there. You can also contact us through the website. Or if you want to become a guest, it's also on the website as well. You register to become a guest, and we'll usually get back within hours. As soon as I get the response, I respond right back.
Rich, I want to thank you once again. Thank you very much for sharing how people can find you and what you are about. I am definitely going to be grabbing that book and learning more and listening more, because I definitely believe that you have a ton to teach the world just from what you've learned in your life and how you've transitioned and how you've done the tough stuff and come out successfully.
Appreciate that. Thanks again for inviting me on, and let me hang out with you here.
Well, listener, I hope that you enjoyed today's episode and that you learned something about what it's like to be in the military and how to transition back into civilian life. If you are looking for more information about how to transition or anything about the military, actually, why don't you drop over to Misfit Nation and find out what Rich LaMonica has on his show. And don't forget, if you know someone who would find this episode of interest, please pass it on to them and let them know about Misfit Nation. If you know anyone who has a brand story or a unique story of overcoming the difficulties that life likes to throw at us sometimes, and you'd like to share that story on Brand Appeal, there is a form in the Appealing Magazine podcasting issue. and it's page 181, where you can fill out the form and apply to be a guest on Brand Appeal. You can find the Appealing magazine at marketappeal.com. Just click on the cover of the magazine and it will lead you to where you need to go. Until next time, peel out.